I walked with my wife over here. Can you hear me in the back row? And that was, it wasn't as bad as the time before when I walked by myself. And so to make time pass, I tried to remember what the four intellectual virtues were. And I could only think of three of them. I miss justice. How can you do something before the preamble? Before the preamble, I'll give the primal sentence from which this comes. Sir Walter Scott is the author of Waverley. Zero, preamble. Scott Buchanan is the author of Poetry and Mathematics. Since for clarity I had to state that fact, let me turn that sentence into a problem for you. Scott Buchanan and the author of Poetry and Mathematics are equal. Let us substitute equals for equals, mathematical reasoning, to make these two new sentences. Scott Buchanan is Scott Buchanan. The author of Poetry and Mathematics is the author of Poetry and Mathematics. The last two sentences, of course, are identities. But the first sentence, while factual, is not an identity. It tells us something about the first founding dean of St. John's College, about a book he wrote in 1929. Do you have a solution to the problem? Why are the equal things not the same? More than that, I want to know whether or not the problem seems important to you. One, you're allowed to laugh at this sentence. I find Scott Buchanan's book annoying and even exasperating. And it is so to me for many reasons. First of all, although the title is Poetry and Mathematics, there are no lines of poetry in Buchanan's book. That it is written entirely in prose. Now, while a book on humor may legitimately be humorless, I do want to know what Scott Buchanan responded to, but I can't seem to find out from his book, Poetry and Mathematics. He seems to take it for granted that we know what poetry is, but he doesn't take it for granted that we know with what mathematics deals. My evidence for that is that Buchanan has chapters entitled Figures, numbers, proportions, equations, functions, and symbols. Thus, he seems to think that mathematics is about those. However, there are no chapters headed by poetic terms until the last chapter, which is called Tragedy and Comedy. And even in that chapter, he begins not with poetry, but with mathematics. Perhaps this is not so surprising, since he calls poetry and mathematics ghosts. I'd love to know what comes into your mind when you hear that. He calls poetry and mathematics ghosts that we cannot tell apart. Scott Buchanan is so allusive and illusive that we can never quite find out what he thinks. I wrote down allusive and illusive, but that isn't the best way to see it. Maybe if I just said foggy. Two. Scott Buchanan doesn't mention particular poems, and almost for that reason, I want to start this talk with this poem, Poetry by Marianne Moore. If the acoustics here work, it'll be recited by a former poet laureate, Robert Kinski.
Poetry. I, too, dislike it. There are things that are important beyond all this fiddle. Reading it, however, with a perfect contempt for it, one discovers in it, after all, a place for the genuine. Hands that can grasp, eyes that can dilate, hair that can rise if it must, these things are important, not because a high-sounding interpretation can be put upon them, but because they are useful. When they become so derivative as to become unintelligible, the same thing may be said for all of us. that we do not admire what we cannot understand, the bat holding on upside down or in quest of something to eat, elephants pushing, a wild horse taking a roll, a tireless wolf under a tree, the immovable critic twitching his skin like a horse that feels a flea, the baseball fan, the statistician. Nor is it valid to discriminate against business documents and school books. All these phenomena are important. One must make a distinction, however, when dragged into prominence by half-poets, the result is not poetry. Nor, till the poets among us can be, literalists of the imagination, above insolence and triviality, and can present for inspection imaginary gardens with real toads in them, shall we have it. In the meantime, if you demand on the one hand the raw material of poetry in all its rawness, and that which is on the other hand genuine, you are interested in poetry.
Marianne Moore was always rewriting her poems, so that this version had a difference or two between the one on the screen than the one Pinsky read, and it's instructive. I heard a tape of Marianne Moore reading some of her poems. Unfortunately, she didn't read poetry on that tape. When she talked a little before she read her poems, Ms. Moore said that, "They call me a poet because they can't think of any other name for me." She also said that an official from the Carnegie Foundation said that he, the official, was at a loss to find a single lyric passage in all of her writings. She pretended that she was sorry that her audience came all the way to the hall to hear nothing but prosaic passages. I think she might have been a little hurt by that. 3, I started this talk with a poem because I didn't like the fact that Buchanan didn't have any poetry proper in his book. But I have 4 more reasons for starting my talk with this poem poetry. First of all, it is obviously a modern poem, and modernity is an important element in both poetry and mathematics. And I think I would fault Buchanan for that, too. He did not make a large thing about modern poems versus poems from way back, nor did he make a big thing, and here's where I really fault him, about modern mathematics versus ancient mathematics. About 100 years ago, mathematics changed its nature. It was strongly influenced by projective geometry and the non-Euclidean geometries. There's a new book which looks very fine to me by Jeremy Gray called Ghost of Plato. It sets out to explain what he calls a modernist transformation in mathematics. Gray says if there's a single exemplary work that ushers in modernism, it's perhaps Hilbert's Foundations of Geometry. Or he says maybe it's Dedekind's What Are Numbers and What Are They For? Unfortunately, in this book by Jeremy Gray ignores the more important earlier transformation into symbolic mathematics brought about by Descartes in 1637 and before that by Viète. Back to poetry. Almost 100 years ago, poets began writing poems that were more relaxed in form than poets had been writing before that. They seem to love their new freedom. Marianne Moore did. The banner for modern English poetry was proclaimed by Ezra Pound in one of his cantos. He used 2 characters from the Chinese. That's not what I want. There's one of them. Make it new. Every day, there's the sun coming up. Every day, make it new. I wish I could say that in Chinese. I tried. I failed. There they are. There it is, the way it sits in his cantos. Make it new. Does that seem like you, a banner? If you were a poet, it would be that banner. They would have done it with or without the banner, but make it new daily. Daily, make it new. I planned in my retirement to read a modern poem every day. But when I retired, I kept on teaching part-time, as many of you know. And thus I was defeated in carrying out my plan. But now, after this lecture, after next week in Santa Fe, perhaps I can begin to do so. Problem for me, why did I think I should read a poem every day? And why a modern poem? What is important, however, is that for the reader of poetry, one can nevertheless enjoy reading and studying traditional poems, poems from any era. The poet, however, may not enjoy that same freedom. If poets write old-fashioned poetry, they're very likely to be ignored, even if the poems are rather fine. Moreover, by the change in mathematics brought about Descartes and company, this may be extremely important, but most of you might know this, a veil is placed over the mathematics of the ancients, and not many make their way back to pre-symbolic mathematics. If this is an important sentence, but I can't talk much about it here. If ancient mathematics contains a key to what being is, I'll read that again. If ancient mathematics contains a key to what being is, then we as moderns are not able to understand their hint, not as moderns, about what being truly is or genuinely is from the poem. And I was about to say that. Poetry contains the notion genuine. It's mentioned on the third and last lines. She doesn't enjoy poetry that's written by half poets. That's Marianne Moore doesn't. I'm anxious about genuine mathematicians. This is a question for you again, or a problem. Is bad mathematics mathematics written by half mathematicians? Problem. But can you solve all these? In the third place, I like the irony that apparently she did dislike her own poem poetry. For when Ms. Moore's complete poetry was published, that poem is included, but it's diminished in size to 3 lines from 30 lines. Her complete poems are shorter than her poems. In the shorter version, the word genuine occurs only once as the last word of the poem. In the longer version, it's mentioned in the third and the last lines. In the shorter version, it occurs as the very last word. Listen, poetry is still the title. I too dislike it. Reading it, however, with a perfect contempt for it, one discovers in it, after all, a place for the genuine. Now maybe you can teach me why she shortened, took 27 lines away. My fourth reason for starting with the poem poetry is that I want to be able to say, maybe this is the whole reason for this lecture, I do want to be able to say, mathematics, I too dislike it. Studying it, however, as opposed to the reading it, however, I too dislike it. Studying it, mathematics, however, with a perfect contempt for it, one discovers in it, after all, a place for the genuine. Once upon a time, when I was at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory, I had to list on my income tax return what my profession was, and I was a mathematician. Nevertheless, during my time as a mathematician, I could still say, mathematics. I too dislike it. Scott Buchanan in his book seems to believe that when anyone dislikes mathematics, it's because that person had bad teachers. Giving you time to think about that, would you accept that as the reason why people dislike mathematics, and many do or claim to? Now, having bad teachers indeed leads to disliking mathematics, but there seem to me to be more important reasons. One of which is that the terms that mean so much to us, love and lust, health, old age, marriage, divorce, sleep and death, as some examples, but I thought as I was getting ready to come here, God does not appear in mathematics proper. Another reason is that the proofs in mathematics, even for important theorems, can be long and difficult to understand, and hence can be frustrating. The great Andrew Wiles proved the great proposition. It became famous because what was written in the margin of a book, that Fermat's Last Theorem, I'll call it that for short. He proved it. He had to prove it twice because there was an error in it. There were many difficulties, but there was one grand error in it the first time. And nevertheless, Andrew Wiles, with the help of a graduate student, he was determined to do it. And he, disregarding everything else, including his wife and children, he solved the problem. And aside, Scott Buchanan says that it's a mistake to think that mathematics is about proof. Now open Euclid's Elements, and almost all of it consists of proofs, statements of propositions, which of course you have to have, and they're proofs. Problem. How can Scott Buchanan deny that mathematics is about proofs? Three. Now I want to choose two examples from that vast body of poetry in English. And when I say in English, it raises a distinction between poetry and mathematics. The language matters so much when we're reading poetry proper. And in mathematics, we seem to have an almost universal language. I'll choose the poems in 14 lines called sonnets. And from the gigantic tree of mathematics, that's a problem for you too. Is mathematics like a tree? I'm going to choose the number line. The particular sonnet I'm choosing is probably the most beloved of Shakespeare's sonnets. It's number 116. I just heard it repeated in the movie Sense and Sensibility. I forget whether it's all over the book that way. But should it be the most beloved, or does it mean the very opposite of what at first it seems to mean? Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments, if any man do allege and declare any impediment why they may not be coupled together in matrimony, etc. Notice that it does not say, I do not admit any impediments to the marriage of true minds, but instead, let me not. Love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds. A is not A is intolerable in mathematics. But here, love is not genuine love, stolen from Marianne Moore's poem, the word, which changes when it finds the beloved changed, or bends with the remover to remove. Should someone cause the departure of the beloved, this will not affect the genuine marriage of true minds. This then is the first quatrain. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. And this measured speech is the, well, it isn't, but behind it is the ta-dum, 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 ta-dum. Perhaps it relates to our marching in thought in tune with our heartbeat. No, a little faster than our heartbeat. Sonnet 169 is not as regular as the first line of Shakespeare 79. I got sonnet 79 on my computer today. They sent me a sonnet a day from Shakespeare, and it was up to 79 today. The first line of that is, whilst I alone did call upon thy aid. It's very regular compared to, let me not to the marriage of true minds. The variation from the ta-dums in 116 enlivens the lines of poetry. The next quatrain begins, "Oh no, it is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken." And goes on to say, "It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Genuine love is fixed like the North Star. All the other stars in our northern hemisphere deviate from their apparent position in the sky, making circles for us. But the North Star is an ever-fixed mark. And for those sailing in a boat, they may count on the North Star. His constancy means more to them than any mathematical calculation of its position." Love's not another negative. Love's not time's fool. Anyone who is not genuinely in love is under the power of time. Love's not time's fool, though rosy cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his, that is time's, brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. Time takes over in this third quatrain. Time reigns over rosy cheeks, but the genuine love of true minds escapes time until the love will be examined on the judgment day. And what will the judgment be? Genuine love did not fail. The final couplet tests the definition. "If this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved." Probably in Shakespearean time, the words were rhymed better than they do now. "If all human love fails to some extent," I better say that three times, "if all human love, loves, plural, fail to some extent, if all human loves fail to some extent, then the definition is empty, for no one ever loved in this way. And the speaker in the poem, not Shakespeare, is a lout. And the poem is teasing us about providing a definition for genuine love. Human love is bittersweet, or in Greek, sweet bitter. And this poem pretends to ignore that truth. However, if the poem is talking about divine love, then the speaker is not a lout, and Shakespeare did dare to write a sonnet unlike those in the sequence before and after it. For those poems are about loves that do change. For me, the meaning of this poem is a problem. Let's turn to our example in mathematics, the number line. It springs to life. When does the number line spring to life? It springs to life when two points are chosen on it. One is a 0 and one is a 1. They have to be different points. 0 is quite an invention, or is it a discovery? Under multiplication, it diminishes any number to 0. Under addition, it fails to contribute anything, for every number added to 0 remains itself. The other point, 1, is fine in modern mathematics. But remember that in antiquity, number was a multitude, so that there one is the very opposite of number. For the ancients, one is at the beginning of number, yet not a number, just as a point can be at the beginning of a line, but the point is certainly not a line. The image of the number line becomes wonderful when we postulate that for every point on the line, there is a real number, and vice versa. We call that relationship a one-to-one correspondence. The key word there is postulate. And some of you, most of you maybe think, you don't have to postulate it. There is a one-to-one correspondence between the between the real numbers and the points on a line. And I understand that relationship. We identify the origin itself with the number 0. We immediately know, do you admit this, where all the rational numbers are, such as 7/10. And there's a simple geometric construction to find any rational number on the number line. For a moment, shrink your image just to the interval 0 to 1. That's good enough. The square root of 2 won't be there, but 1 might take the 1 away, 4.414213562, etc. The fractional part of it will be there. Just focus on that image. I'll call that the whole line, and even that part of it, the continuum. And I'll speak about the enigma of the continuum. I think Leibniz called it the labyrinth of the continuum, but I believe that Leibniz felt he had a solution to the problem of the continuum. Anyway, my favorite numbers occur between negative 1 and 4. And I hope they're going to be on this next slide. There they are. So the intervals, I speak loudly now and away from it. The intervals are from negative 1 to 0, 1, 2, 3. I don't need 4. And my 5 of my 6 favorite numbers are up there. Let's start with tau. Tau is about 1.62. It's the golden number. It means that that interval is broken in a, what Euclid calls extreme and mean ratio. Tau has a sister called sigma. Sigma's negative, and sigma and tau together add up to 1. And the reason I call them sister and brother is that if you solve the equation to get the solution, you get 2 solutions, and one of them's going to be the one we're used to from the golden ratio, about 1.62. But they both have the property that their squares are 1 more than they are. And they're irrational numbers. They both involve the square root of 5. They're half of 1 plus the square root of 5 and half of 1 minus the square root of 5. And there they sit up there, sigma and tau. Sigma negative. Pi, you're very much familiar with. We think it's the has to do with the ratio of the circumference to the diameter or the area to the radius or the diameter. The other two aren't so well known, but students of the calculus know E, Euler's number. It turns up all over the place in mathematics. And if I tried to define it now, that would be the whole talk. And gamma, worse. But there's a whole book written on both. There's a book written on pi, of course, and there's a book written on E, and there's a lot of books written on the golden ratio, and there's even a book written on gamma, a whole book. Gamma's a little more than a half. Those are my five favorites. So why do I have 6 numbers up there? Well, Euler, here I go, away from the mic. Let's talk about something prior to this. 1 plus a half plus a third plus a quarter plus a fifth plus a sixth. What happens to that? I guess all calculus students know it just keeps getting larger and larger and larger, and it gets as large as you please. These are just the squares of those terms. But the fact that they're squares mean that they do converge to something. They get as close as you please to something, and that's something I've marked with a question mark. My suspicion is I only peeked at the new calculus manual with Leibniz in it. My suspicion is that that isn't in that book because it's a little bit difficult and because Leibniz couldn't get it. Here's what goes on in my imagination. If only I could have lived at that time when this is called the Basel problem for Basel in Switzerland, and where John Bernoulli picked up this problem, which had been known even before that, and the Bernoullis worked on it and they couldn't get it. And I'm sure I would have calculated. And what would I have noticed? Nobody said this before. I discovered this yesterday. This number keeps getting closer and closer to tau. And to get five figures correctly, you have to do 30,000 terms. Put it in technical language, it converges very, very slowly. So I would have said, my heart is beating faster. Poetry is ruined for me because it isn't beating with the lines as I say them. Because I'm going to show that this series goes to tau because it's very close. And if I plotted them, it would lie right on tau. So you can't imagine how thrilled I am. That's false mathematics. That's bad mathematics. Can there be bad mathematics? But it does go to something strange. Pi squared over 6. Euler, E-U-L-E-R. Euler proved that in a very illegitimate way. It's the only proof I know. But I know he came up with other proofs later, and I could follow them, though I haven't. Even Euler, stern as he was, might have had been thrilled by solving the Basel problem. It gets as close as you please to pi squared over 6. Problem. What is this pi, which is has to do with the circle and its radius and ratio between them, doing as the sum of an arithmetic series? Not only that, but it doesn't occur as pi, it occurs as pi squared. I'll never find where I am in this now. Do you down there in the audience, I wish I were down there, imagine that you're familiar with the real numbers? You've been looking at the number line ever since you were in I don't know in what grade. Let's just take one, not the ones up there. Let's take E if you want. 2.7 and so on. I have a method of calculating the next digit as far as I please. And if I can't do it by hand, I'll start to do it on a calculator. And how can I do that? How can I have confidence that I can always calculate the next number? And the answer is to use, I guess, something from the Arabic. There's an algorithm for getting the very next number. So, of course we know the numbers. The square root of 2, maybe I only know by heart, 14142133562, but I'm very confident I have a method. I could even use trial and error to get the next digit. So yes, that's my first answer. Yes, I understand the real numbers. I know what they mean. Okay, those decimals go on and on and on, but I'm used to that just with the counting numbers. They go on and on and on. If I start counting, let's see, Aristotle coined a word for what happens if you count. Hodos means way. Exodus, you're aware of that word, means way out. Dia exodus, way out through. Put an alpha privative in front of it, no way out through. So if I start counting, I won't ever be able to do anything else because there's no way out through. I've got to step aside or I can't live my life. So it's the same with these. The decimals, they 1414, etc., they keep going on and on and on. So it's now I'm saying it doesn't seem to me it's any more difficult than is in the counting numbers themselves that the ancients had. Well, there is a grand difficulty. The rational numbers we do understand very well, but the irrationals are exceedingly difficult to get a hold of. Not some of them, not the ones for which we have an algorithm. But we can't get all of them. I'll just hint at two ways, and I apologize for hinting. What if I took a tiny interval, as small as you please, a very tiny interval, then I can, in a systematic way, put sub-intervals around each one of the rational numbers. And in some, they'll be smaller than that very tiny interval. Mathematicians say that the rational numbers have measure zero. But the irrational numbers, I can't do that with. So in the unit interval, the mathematicians say the irrationals have measure one. All the width of the interval comes from the irrational numbers. They so outpace the rationals that the difference is unimaginable. Another way to see the insignificance of the rational points compared to the irrational ones is to use names. Every rational number has a name. No matter which scheme of naming we use, there are not enough names for all the irrational numbers. Or are there? Here's the enigma of the continuum. Either assume that you understand that each irrational is given by a non-repeating infinitesimal and that your reason comprehends that description, or stick to the ones which you can compute or the ones for which you have an algorithm. If I say I'm not going to accept, I'll put it in a single phrase. I'll only accept the computable reals. I will not accept any which are not computable. Don't think, however, that the last option is comfortable. Don't think that if you stick to the computable reals, it's a comfortable position. Why not? Take your line, take points on either side of it at random, and join them. If you stick to the computable reals, you're not certain that there'll be an intersection. I'm very uncomfortable. So in both poetry and mathematics, there are enigmas. And neither of these ghosts, as Buchanan calls poetry and mathematics, are comfortable for us. Mathematics, it turns out, is no more determinable than poetry is. Four. Get rid of that, if I can. Scott Buchanan reveals in his book Poetry and Mathematics one of his peculiarities. Maybe you should remember this anecdote. Whenever Scott Buchanan says is, he means is like. He says that this bothers his literal-minded friends. Would you be one of those? I think he was thinking of Mortimer Adler. At any rate, this peculiarity allows us to say in Buchanan's private language, mathematics is poetry, or poetry is mathematics, for they're like one another. Of course those ghosts can't be told apart. It's time now, at this point in the lecture, to extend each of the ghosts, but in different ways. Let us extend poetry to include novels, short stories, and the like. In this way, we've extended poetry to include all literature. Although I had a friend who contended that Newton's Principia is part of literature. Let us, however, include nothing but, and what kinds of literature shall we have? There's too much. How about only including genuine literature? That is the best literature. Then we shall call that extension the world of letters or the republic of letters. Now let us extend the number line, but in a very different way. So here's the number line. I'm going to pull it apart. The number line has become the number plane. This image is called the complex plane. We've obtained this image from Gauss and a couple of others who lived in his same time. The magic of this image is brought about when we discover, not invent, discover that multiplication in the image is obtained by merely rotating lines. I think Henry Aguirre in his lecture talked about that form of multiplication. Let us call the realm of the complex numbers the world of numbers. Sometimes I like to call it the republic of numbers. Mathematicians, however, will insist that there are many more kinds of numbers than the complex numbers. But the complex numbers do have some special claims. For instance, every number has a square root. Now, negative one doesn't have a square root when you're stuck on the line, but when you extend the plane, there's a definite point, which is the square root of negative one, and we call it I. All the numbers in that plane can be written in the form A plus BI, where A and B are real. With this wonderful image, Gauss was able to figure out at age 19 exactly which regular polygons were constructible. And that's not the way we would have guessed. Euclid would have been amazed to find out that. He would have assumed already that a seven-sided polygon is not constructible because mathematicians tried it and couldn't do it. But he would have been shocked to find out that 17-sided polygon is easily constructible. And Gauss and no one else in the world at that time knew exactly which ones could be and which ones couldn't be. That's when you use only a straight lines and circles, a straight edge and compass, if you want. I desire three more republics or worlds. Of course, I must mention Plato's so-called Republic. That book, of course, pertains to both poetry and mathematics. Why do I say that? Save it for a second. Poetry comes from poesis, which means making. Mathematics comes from anthane, which means to learn and hence knowing. Thus, we've extended the title of Buchanan's book to be Making and Knowing. And I've extended the title of my lecture to be Making and Knowing. And is it funny that making precedes knowing? I don't know. And at last, we know what Buchanan's title and the title of this lecture really mean. So I can speak of poetry proper. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? I can think of mathematics proper. The theorem of Pythagoras, which Buchanan puts the theory of, he puts Euclid 147 in his book. This is the most perplexing thing I can think of. So there it sits in Heath's translation, and how can it mean anything to his readers? Because they're not steeped in Euclid's mathematics. It would, every time there's an assertion, they would have no understanding of why Euclid made that assertion. Plato's dialogue, Politeia, contains a great making or construction by his character Socrates, the city in speech, which is headed by a philosopher ruler. And in that dialogue, the philosopher king or queen is a knower. Since it is ruled by only one, it is not, strictly speaking, a republic. However, and this is weird, poets are banned in that city. Why? That's not a problem. It's really easy. They lie. They lie about the gods. And even worse, maybe not worse, they lie about what really is. Problem. Should we also ban the poet, Plato, who made that city? Remember, making. Poet. Then, and I spent a good part of last summer reading about this, there's our republic, the Republic of the United States of America. Who made it? Not one poet like Plato, but there were 55 men who went to Philadelphia in 1787. In only a few months, they came up with a document which only 39 of those 55 signed. When they finished their work, what did they have? Their best try, or we could say they had their opinions. It needed to be ratified by the states. Problem, next to the last problem, and I'm drawing to the end of this talk, are we still under that same Constitution? Lastly, there's the Republic of St. John's College. To a large extent, Scott Buchanan made this republic. While there are no lines of poetry in Buchanan's book, Poetry and Mathematics, in a larger sense, his life is pure poetry. How does he teach Scott Buchanan in this book, Poetry and Mathematics? Now I've got the perfect word. By provocation. Maybe that's the best way to teach, isn't it? Isn't that the way that Socrates teaches in the dialogues? At any rate, he provoked me into thinking about this lecture. Last problem. Is St. John's College today the same college that Scott Buchanan helped to make? Thank you for listening. Thank you.